I'm John Krall. Today on No Limits, we're going to talk about ways to draw the maps that determine where people vote and for whom they vote, and ways that produce elections that are more fair and more representative of the state and country. We're going to talk about rethinking redistricting. My guests will be Julia Vaughn of Common Cause Indiana, Debbie Asbury of the League of Women Voters, Indy, and Alex Eisenstadt of Politico. Please join the conversation by calling 1-866-476-3881, emailing nolimits@wfyi.org, or connecting with us via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Now, this news.
No Limits is made possible by WGU Indiana, Indiana's 8th state university. Information about earning a degree from WGU, an accredited online nonprofit university, is available at indiana.wgu.edu. And by Apparatus, managing IT infrastructure so companies don't have to. It's advanced IT made simple. Learn more at apparatus.net.
Welcome to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We are talking today about rethinking redistricting. We're going to get to talk an awful lot about the fine art of gerrymandering, or the dark art, we probably ought to call it. If you would like to join the conversation, you can do so by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org, or you can connect with us via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. My guests are Julia Vaughn of Common Cause Indiana. Julia, welcome back to the program.
Thanks so much.
It's good to have you here. And Debbie Asbury, who is with League of Women Voters, Indy. Debbie, welcome to the program.
Thank you, John. It's great to be here.
And we will be joined shortly by Alex Eisenstadt of Politico. Well, let's talk a little bit. First, we probably ought to explain to people, I know we all get the concept, but strange as it may seem, there are people out there who don't live, breathe, and think about public policy and politics all the time. Julia, give me a definition of what gerrymandering is.
Well, it's drawing of political districts to benefit either a political party or even an individual. And it's been practiced here in Indiana, like it has in a lot of other states, for a very long time, and both political parties are guilty of it. So it's something that it's a disservice to voters because it helps to make a lot of our elected officials less accountable. Mm-hmm. If you're elected from a district that was drawn to be 60-65% your party, it's very likely you might not face a challenger come re-election time. And if you do, you're almost certainly going to win. So it really is a system that allows elected officials to choose their voters instead of voters choosing our elected officials.
So it reverses the equation.
The natural order of things in a democracy. That's right.
Debbie, how big a problem is this in Indiana? I mean, what are some of the numbers?
Well, Julia's the expert on the numbers. The issue is, though, it's a problem in every state. It's a significant problem in our state. The thinking is that we are more gerrymandered, more partisan now than we ever used to be. The districts are less competitive than they used to be. And that the voters are becoming, because of that, the other issue that's related to it, just as you mentioned earlier, the voters become more disenfranchised and more disillusioned with the process, thinking it doesn't matter. And so it goes deeper than actually just a district and the lines that are drawn. It has a process of really helping voters think, I don't need to participate in this, when in fact they absolutely do.
Julia, I think Debbie gave you your cue. Yep. You're the expert with the numbers here. So,
well, for example, our congressional districts. We have 9 here in Indiana. Really only 2 are considered to be competitive. That's half
Which
as many.
Which 2 of those? We probably.
You put me on the spot here. Well, the 2nd congressional district, which has gotten less competitive, that's one that really used to be in play. It's now represented by Jackie Walorski. So the two competitive ones are really down south, Todd Young District, the district over in the Evansville area. But that has been decreased by half. Back in the previous set of maps, we really had four congressional districts in play. So that's at the national level. At the state, it's just as grim. In the Senate, 25 seats are up every couple years. There are literally one or two that are really in play. In the House, out of 100 seats, generously, there may be 9 or 10 that are truly competitive. So again, one of the reasons why we have poor voter turnout here in Indiana is that in many legislative districts, the outcome is preordained and citizens feel like, you know, why should I go? I don't have any choice here. The districts that were drawn have predetermined election outcomes.
We are talking about rethinking redistricting, talking about the dark art of gerrymandering here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org, or you can connect with us via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. I know one number in the last election that still stuns me is that in the races for the Indiana House of Representatives, Republicans claimed between 53% and 54% of the vote, but got 69% of the seats. How did they do that, Julia?
Through drawing the maps in 2011. They were the folks who controlled both chambers of the General Assembly, so they had absolute say. And they made a lot of protests that, oh, no, they weren't looking at politics. But when you look at the outcomes and the statistics, it's obvious that they were able, through manipulating district lines, really subvert the will of many voters in these individual districts. So it's obvious that, especially because now all of this is done through software and computers, they're not setting out a big map on the floor and using magic markers anymore. I mean, they have honed this down to an absolute science. So it's easier than ever before. The system is not at all transparent. You know, there were 17 days that passed between the introduction of the new maps and their passage into law. That's very little time for the public to review and see how this is going to impact them. So we really have to change the process, and we're excited that here in Indiana, we do actually have some support from some important people in the legislature. Most importantly, the President Pro Tem and the Speaker of the House have said that they are hopeful that the next time redistricting happens in 2021, it won't be the legislature's job, but it will be the job of an independent redistricting commission.
What does, so that we continue kind of defining, it seems to me defining the size of the problem, why it needs to be solved, is a good step in this discussion. And then we can talk about potential solutions. But Debbie, what does distorting it, it sounds like the, you know, if you look at the numbers, distorting the will of the people.
Right.
Due to the process.
Absolutely. Well, it has lovingly been referred to by some legislators who will remain unnamed as the Incumbency Protection Program. and that's exactly what happens. It, and so it weakens the democratic process. It weakens the voters' sense that I have voice and I have agency in what's happening in my country, my city, my county, my world. And when we deepen the democratic process, then we're all in trouble, and it transcends partisan issues, partisan concerns. And that's why partnering with Common Cause and the League of Women Voters, we actually called it Drawing a Line for Democracy, because it is our belief that fundamentally it's beyond incumbency protection, it's beyond legislative maps and people getting voted into office. If there's not the process that's being supported democratically, then we're undermining that.
Let's stay with you for a second. If you'd like to join this conversation, you can do so by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. Debbie, does it add to the kind of dysfunction also that we have seen with probably more with the federal government, but the idea, I mean, what sort of people does, I'm going to give both of you a crack at this because it's a big, fat, slow pitch right down the middle of the plate. Both of you ought to be, have a chance to swing at it. What does it, you know, when you send people like that from very safe districts who do not really, as a process of getting elected, have to engage with people at any level
right.
who disagree with them,
right.
what does that do to the process?
What happens is that when these lines are drawn in the way that Julia explained, then legislators are actually responding to more of the fringes of an ideological base instead of the broader electorate. We are a country, a state, we have counties, districts of diverse perspective, diverse opinions, and when you're working with that kind of diversity, then you need to be able to be governing for the whole. And the issue is, too, that we firmly believe, both in Common Cause and the League of Women Voters, that this is a capacity of governance, not politics, and to be able to understand the difference. So when you're drawing these lines to keep the incumbents in or to protect a particular small interest group, then that's political process. Mm-hmm. And we're concerned about the governing process and the capacity for our legislators to really govern from a broader base and a broader perspective.
Okay, you get to swing now, Julia.
Well, and gerrymandering is electing more ideologues, people mm-hmm. who care more about single issues, who are playing to a single interest group, rather than this broad array of voters that are their constituents and that they're supposed to represent. The recent government shutdown, a national journal looked at the Republican Party and compared it to the government shutdown of the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
The difference this time around is that there were only 17 Republicans elected from competitive districts versus 79 back in the 90s. And I think we saw the difference in the tenor of the debate this time mm-hmm. and the ability, again, of a very small faction to really bring our federal government to a halt, to a shutdown. So it's allowing a very small group of people to control the process and not be accountable to voters.
Please, Debbie.
To build on what Julia just said, what happens then, and this gets back to our earlier point about undermining the democratic process, it becomes governance by a minority. And our democracy is built upon majority rule. And so that's another example of the difficulties that we have with gerrymandered districts.
We are talking about rethinking redistricting here on No Limits, about gerrymandering. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. Mary, welcome to the program.
Hi there.
Hi. What's on your mind?
Well, I am a student at IUPUI, and I'm a political science student. And I actually did a research project where I looked at the Indiana House of Representatives over the past 10 years and compared party cohesion during different sizes of supermajorities. We've seen, you know, in the past few years, obviously, with the Republicans gaining and gaining in the last election cycles. And then previously, there were different times when the Democrats had control as well, of course. And what my findings showed was that not only were the Republicans far less cohesive when they held the majority, and increasingly as that supermajority increased, but they also seemed to have issues when it came to different areas of the state where, you know, now they were, like you said, they were kind of widening their party umbrella so they could get more seats, but that those different Republicans that they were pulling in, some were more Tea Party in nature, some were more about social issues, some were more about fiscal issues, and that then when it came down to it, there were different times when they were leaving as many as 20 of their own members not voting for different pieces of legislation. And it was very eye-opening to see the way that that process is taking place in Indiana and what that really means in terms of redistricting. Are we now becoming less of a two-party state and more of a slightly, you know, slightly liberal Democrats, and then just a very wide variety of Republicans, and what that will mean for the future?
Good question. Thank you very much for the call, Mary.
Thank you.
Well, I'll throw that is one theory, that when you get a supermajority and you do something like this, the dominant party actually starts breaking into factions, which uh-huh. it begins to provide its own opposition. Julia.
Well, I think that it's interesting research, and you know, I think you could do endless research projects on the House Republican Caucus. They're just a fascinating group of individuals, and I think it points to sort of the problems that leadership faces when you get that large of a majority. Mm-hmm. To me, though, that's sort of separate mm-hmm. from the nuts and bolts of redistricting and the problems that gerrymandering mm-hmm. Brings us. I mean, it is going to be interesting to
although me. Although I think Mary probably would argue the gerrymandering sort of produced that dynamic.
I think it certainly that I would agree with that, absolutely. I think our challenge is we have this huge influx of new legislators who were elected out of gerrymandered districts. So what's their self-interest in promoting reform?
We are talking about rethinking redistricting here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. My guests are Julia Vaughn of Common Cause Indiana and Debbie Asbury of the League of Women Voters Indy. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We're talking about rethinking and redistricting. My guests are here in the studio with me, Julia Vaughn of Common Cause Indiana and Debbie Asbury, the League of Women Voters. And now joining us by phone from, I'm presuming, D.C., is Alex Eisenstadt of Politico. Alex, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
It's good to have you here. We've gotten an email question from a listener named AJ that I think speaks to your expertise and your national perspective, Alex. And it says, Republican legislatures across the country are passing voter ID laws in an effort to limit access to the vote to groups which are likely to vote for the Democratic Party, insisting that they do it to protect the sacredness of the vote of the individual. However, the Republican gerrymandering has stolen far more votes than any fraud the Republicans have alleged to justify their voter ID laws. Gerrymandering is simply nothing more than stealing votes. How widespread a campaign is this around the country?
Well, you know, this is a really, really fascinating question. And in the aftermath of the government shutdown and with so much dissatisfaction with Congress and the widespread view nationally that Congress just can't get anything done and that's just incredibly ineffective, there are now a lot of people who are asking themselves, why is Congress work this way? Why is it so partisan? Why is it that things bipartisanship doesn't happen anymore in the House of Representatives? And there's several schools of thought that are developing among people who study this stuff. And one of them has to do with, as your reader suggests, one of them has to do with gerrymandering or redistricting, which is when you have state legislators draw districts for members of the House of Representatives that are very safe politically. They're designed to protect them from having really tough general election bids. In other words, they're really designed to help secure these lawmakers' reelection. But there are several other dynamics that are also making it so that the House of Representatives is completely partisan. It's just partisanized. One of them you have to look at is sort of what people call in the business sorting. In other words, when you look at the way Americans really are living right now, so if you're a Democrat, chances are you're going to be living next to another Democrat. If you're a Republican, chances are you're going to be living next to another Republican. And so because we're grouping ourselves in this way in America now, that creates a system where you're living in a very Democratic district or a very Republican district where one party or the other is going to control that seat for years to come. But there are other dynamics that are taking place as well. And then some people are taking a look at straight ticket voting. You know, it used to be that people would head into the voting booths and they would vote for maybe a Republican for president and maybe a Democratic congressman or a Democratic congressperson. And that's not happening anymore as much. What people are saying is that, look, if you voted for Mitt Romney last year, the most of the time, nearly all the time, you're voting for a Republican member of Congress. If, on the other hand, you went and voted for Barack Obama, you were, chances are overwhelmingly, that you voted for a Democratic member of Congress. And so all these dynamics, including some others that people are looking at, are sort of all these dynamics are coming into play and creating the system where you have a House of Representatives that is dominated by members who really don't face tough general elections in November.
And we've gotten another email question from a listener named Jerry, who says, I'd like to know what your panel thinks of the following proposed rules for redistricting. One, use a geographical unit that is essentially non-political, i.e. postal zip code, and for which necessary population data are readily available. Two, require that all districts be composed of groups of contiguous geographical units that are as equal as possible in population. Three, require that the perimeter of such districts be the minimum that can be achieved while honoring rules one and two. Four, boy, this is beginning to sound like a math problem. Four, should it be necessary to divide a geographical unit to meet the above requirements, limit the number of such divisions to one per district. Implementing the above rules, he does say, would be computation intensive, but such work is why we have computers. Are there places where... if I can give an overarching question to Jerry's here, are there places where they are able at some level to take the political maneuvering out of redistricting? I'll start with you on that, Alex, but I'm going to give everybody a crack at it.
Yeah, you right now you have to look at California's system as a model. And what you had is a situation, you had this massive redistricting reform that was put into place by Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger. He passed it as part of a ballot initiative several years ago. And California for years was just incredibly gerrymandered. You had this very old, very aging delegation full of members who never faced tough reelection bids. And basically, Arnold Schwarzenegger, under his system, basically pulled the rug out from under these lawmakers and made it so that redistricting was no longer done by the state legislature. It was done by this bipartisan panel of people who, for the most part, had not even been in politics at all. And they redrew the lines, and they created a system where these politicians had to run in completely new territory. Many Republicans who were in very Republican districts now were in swing districts and vice versa for Democrats. And so what you had in the situation was, and this was quite fascinating, was a lot of these lawmakers who never had to face tough political campaigns, they decided to just outright retire and not run campaigns at all. And so what you have in the California delegation is you have a lot of new blood, a lot of young legislators who are bringing new perspectives to the job. And so California has really been a fascinating test case. But, of course, not every state – Arnold Schwarzenegger is no longer governor of California, but not of every state has a governor that's as independent as Arnold Schwarzenegger. And so that makes redistricting reform very hard in most states.
What are the chances, Julia, that we would get a California-like model here in Indiana?
Well, we can't call it the California model.
Well,
we know that.
Yeah.
That really – I've been talking to legislators. Alex is right. For redistricting reformers,
so
California –
So just used to the Pacific Ocean model.
Yeah, somewhere out west a state model. But they are. They really have created a fascinating process that depoliticizes this process as much as you can, an inherently political process. I would just say in response to the caller's question, all of the criteria that he suggests are important, and the equal population and contiguity are already in state statute. I would add, though, that it's important to say in statute that districts respect the voting rights of minority voters. That's an important Voting Rights Act compliance issue. And we think that competition is also important, that districts should be drawn with an eye to drawing as competitive districts as possible. Now, the key thing to remember, though, is that districts cannot be all these things at once. Mm-hmm. So we have to rank this criteria. We have to say that one is more important than another. And that's going to be a discussion that the people of Indiana need to have. But California presents us with a great model. We just have to figure out how to sell that to the General Assembly.
Well, and Debbie, when we talk about what would the priorities be, at least from the League of Women Voters perspective?
Everything that Julia just said, I think protecting the minority rights. There's some conversation about communities of interest. They absolutely need to be contiguous and continuous. A friend of mine asked yesterday, well, what does that mean, continuous and contiguous? It's so that you're not so manipulating a process that you have a little round circle over here and then you go over here to another part of the county or the state and you draw another little circle and you say, oh, and that's a district. They follow natural boundaries. The other thing that we've talked about with folks around the state who are really interested in this, David Ornliker has some great ideas about what this might look like, is that if you had an independent commission, that independent commission would be asking these independent questions. Mm-hmm. They wouldn't be so locked into, well, how do we make this district safe? How do we make sure that we get the incumbents back into power? Those would not be their operative questions. And so over time, as you build this process, then you ask the questions that support voting rights, minority rights, democratic principles.
We are talking about rethinking redistricting here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org, or you can connect with us via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Steve, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Certainly. What's on your mind?
The question that I would ask is, how are you going to get people to participate? As it is now, even in your gerrymandered districts, voter turnout tends to be only those that are upset at something. How do you get people? How do you get a good wide range of people coming out? Because now, if you get like in a Republican district, if the incumbent gets Tea Party mad, then he loses in the primary, he's lost the election. Wasn't that what happened to one of the congressmen, or was it the senator in I can't remember
here in Indiana with Richard Lugar basically fell last year.
Here in Indiana,
Richard Lugar. Yeah. And that's a good question, Steve, because it speaks to what happens when we make the primary really the election that counts.
Right, and people don't show up.
Yes. Okay. Thanks very much for the call and the question, Steve. Alex, I'm going to let you have the first crack at that. What does happen when we make the primary the election that matters?
Well, that's essentially the system that we have in place right now. I mean, you look at what's developing the 2014 cycle for congressional races, and you know, you talk to most strategists from both parties, and they say, look, we're going to have only two to three dozen really competitive general election races at all of over 400 seats, 435 seats. Well, that gives you just an idea of just how small the universe of competitive general elections really is. Instead, most of the action is going to be in primaries, where winning a primary is going to be tantamount to election. And so you're going to have a lot of the action is going to be in Republican primaries, where you're going to have business groups battling the Tea Party and Tea Party battling business groups. And that's where a lot of the action is going to be, and where a lot of reporters like myself are going to be spending our time next year.
What does that do to the process, Alex?
The process of
governing, of governing.
Yeah. Well, you know, look, it's created a situation where the House Republican Conference has moved unmistakably to the right over the last few years. No one would dispute the fact that this is a very conservative House Republican Conference. And for that matter, you also have no one pays attention to this because they're not in power. But House Democrats are an extraordinarily liberal set of people. You have so it creates this dynamic in the House where you have very liberal Democrats and very conservative Republicans who agree on basically nothing. And that's why you have standoffs like you have with the fiscal cliff, like you have with the farm bill, like you had with the government shutdown. On every major piece of legislation, on every controversial piece of legislation, it's very hard for the House to get something done. Now, you contrast that with the Senate, and this is interesting. People want to know why the Senate has an easier time getting things done than the House, and why Republicans in the Senate are more moderate than Republicans in the House, and why Democrats in the Senate are more moderate than their House counterparts. And it's because when you're a senator, you have to represent the entire state. You're in charge of, and you're responding to a broader demographic of voters. And so you get in many cases a more moderate set of voters, a mixture of Democrats and Republicans. But then you take a House member, most of the time they're simply just responsive to Democrats or Republicans. And so what you basically see in the House is this dynamic where it's just really hard to get anything done. And a lot of it has to do with those kinds of political dynamics.
Is there a chance, though, that kind of dynamic could spill over to the Senate side? I mean, we are talking here from a studio in the middle of Indiana, where Richard Lugar admittedly was politically conservative, was a philosophic conservative, but at least in terms of temperament, he was a moderate presence, and certainly a pragmatist in terms of getting things done. But, you know, it was a Tea Party candidate who took him out. Alex, I'll throw that one to you.
Yeah, and look, and this doesn't just have to do with redistricting. I mean, a lot of there are broad disagreements within the Republican Party, and those don't just take place in the House; they take place in the Senate as well. A lot of that has to do with what you saw with Dick Lugar is the same thing you're seeing in a lot of other states, where the Republican primary electorate, those voters who are going to be motivated to go out and vote in a primary, and this is going to be especially true next year when it's not a presidential election year, it's a midterm year, and so you're going to have a set of voters who are going to go out and vote. These are going to be the most motivated people. These are going to be the most politically attuned people, the most activist type of people. And in many cases, those are the people who are the most conservative. And so if you're a more moderate Republican, you've got to be worried about facing a conservative candidate. And so that's what happened in Indiana, and you're starting to see that dynamic spill out in other Republican primaries next year. So we'll see how successful these Tea Party kind of candidates are in Senate races next year. You have Mitch McConnell, the Senate Minority Leader. He has a challenge. You have Mike Enzi getting a challenge from Dick Cheney's daughter, of all people. So we're going to see how this plays out. But you're right in sort of asserting that the Indiana race last year was a good model of that Republican rift.
We are talking about rethinking redistricting here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org, or you can connect with us via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. We've gotten a really provocative question from a listener named Drew by email, and it says, how much of gerrymandering is due to the two-party system, and how much of the two-party system is due to gerrymandering? Debbie, I'm going to throw that one to you first.
Well, isn't it interesting? Yes, we have this perpetual wheel that's going around. Read Drew's question again. How much of gerrymandering is due to the two-party system?
Yeah, and how much of the two-party system is due to gerrymandering?
Oh, well, that's a good question. I might pitch that back over to Julia.
In other words, you're punning.
Yeah, I'm pivoting, as they say. That's a great question. I think that it does. Gerrymandered districts absolutely is a recipe for the status quo. I think that's one thing that we can say, and that it reduces the capacity for innovative thinking. It reduces the capacity for what Alex was talking about, that in the good old days, if it were, there would be many ilks of Democrats, and there would be many ilks of Republican. Mm-hmm. There would be a common core of who they were mm-hmm. that differentiated them one from the other. But there was some nice sort of spilling over, and that isn't happening anymore. Both parties are moving further and further into more of an ideological boundary and the capacity for compromise, the capacity for working together, even the rewards for working together are becoming less and less.
So that it reinforces the litmus test.
Well,
Julia.
And it's simply not reflective of the American electorate. The bottom line is most of us are pretty much in the middle of the road. So these folks on the extremes are not representative of us. And that is, you know, inherently undemocratic.
In terms of where things are going, Alex, since you do have a national perspective on this, real quickly, is it likely to get better or worse?
Well, there's nothing to suggest that it's going to get any better. And part of that has to do with the fact that this partisanship, it doesn't just have to do with just redistricting alone.
That's right.
I mean, you know, and people are taking a look at this and trying to figure out why this is. But you know, look, I mean, we're living in an age of Twitter, we're living in an age of talk radio, we're living in an age of cable news, we're living in an age of super PACs. All these things are all these dynamics tend to amplify the loudest voices in the room. And so, you know, moderate voices, and look, there's...
Alex, I'm sorry, we're running up on a break here. Thank you very much for being with us. You are listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We are talking about rethinking redistricting. My guests now are Julia Vaughn of Common Cause Indiana and Debbie Asbury of the Legal Women Voters Indy. We got an email question from a listener named John, and if you would like to join the conversation by sending us an email, you can do so by sending it to nolimits@wfyi.org. Says, if you can, please connect an issue such as taxation, same-sex marriage, or even smoking to redistricting. In other words, have the day-to-day lives of citizens been affected by gerrymandering? That actually, I think, is two questions. So why don't we take the first one first? You know, it seems to me probably the easiest example to tie this to is the whole same-sex marriage question, the big issue in front of the legislature right now.
I agree. You know, I think that much of this is driven by the fear of some incumbents in the General Assembly that they're being watched closely by conservatives and that they will face a challenge in the primary if this issue doesn't come to a head next session. So clearly, I think there would be a very different atmosphere around this issue in the General Assembly if there weren't so many Republicans elected from districts that are very slanted.
Mm-hmm. Doesn't it, I mean, in some ways it sort of crystallizes what happens here because, not to put too fine a point on it, you've got two big constituencies that seem to be moving in opposite directions on this. You've got the business community saying they don't want a ban in the Constitution. You've got social conservatives saying that they do. Traditionally, those tend to be Republican constituencies, and you know the effect here is that they are making the primary election the one that matters. Debbie.
Well, that's absolutely right. And to get to the emailer's question, too, the second part of that, is it impacting individuals' lives? Absolutely, because what happens is that we have a democracy that actually isn't the democracy in the way that we've understood it, and we have partisan boxes. And these legislators are responsive and accountable to these tinier representations of ideologies, of particular ideas, and the broader questions, the broader issues, the broader common sense kind of thinking often doesn't prevail because they're not the ones that would ultimately, in the primary, with these gerrymandered districts, they're not the ones that the legislators are accountable to.
We've gotten a Facebook comment from a listener who says, I have always been proud, and I think it speaks to what you're talking about right now, Debbie. I have always been proud of my congressional representative, Andy Jacobs, Julia Carson, Andre Carson, who accurately reflected my concerns about hunger, poverty, and social justice issues, such as immigration reform. And then I was redistricted. Now my representative is Susan Brooks, who shares few of my values.
I don't live in Carmel, and I don't agree with most people in Carmel about these issues. I don't appreciate my vote being diluted by gerrymandering. Mm-hmm. Julia, could you talk a little bit about that? What she's really talking about here is a sense of disenfranchisement.
And, you know, I think that's one thing that the General Assembly did do a favor for us in 2011. So many people were redistricted out of a district that they had come to know whether it was state legislator or congressperson, and, you know, had related to them, felt like they were representative of their views and their positions on issues. So, yeah, I think that people get a sense that gerrymandering has taken their voice away from them and their ability to really have faith that their elected officials are going to seriously consider their opinions. I mean, I think most of us accept the fact that we don't expect our elected officials to 100% of the time do what we think they should do. But we want to at least think that when we call and write their office, they don't automatically send our comments to the trash can if we're one of those people who isn't likely to vote to reelect them. So I think there's just this demise in participation when people feel like, my voice doesn't matter. I can't tell you how many people, when I would suggest they contact Congressman Burton's office, for example, would say, now, why in the world would I do that? You know, he's never going to listen to me. And again, representing a 65-70% Republican district has a tendency to make people feel like if you're not one of those mm-hmm. people, your voice isn't going to be heard.
We are talking about rethinking redistricting here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org, or you can connect with us via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Well, let's talk about we've already talked about that state out west whose name we're not supposed to mention in connection with the model. As a possibility, are there any other models out there that offer some hope if the whole California thing proves to be insurmountable?
One of the things that we're starting to talk about is, you know, we have this process to select judges in Indiana, mm-hmm. for example, the Indiana Supreme Court, that seems to have worked pretty well. We've, you know, not had a court that certainly has embarrassed us at all, and most people agree that they seem to have done a good job. So we're looking at possibly figuring out how could we adapt the Judicial Nominating Commission to work for creating an independent redistricting commission. We're also having some talk about, you know, the Indiana Constitution directs the Indiana mm-hmm. General Assembly to draw the lines. So there's some disagreement even within the General Assembly.
Constitutional amendment.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's hard enough to pass a law, but you start talking about
a very cumbersome process.
Extremely cumbersome. And we're also having to educate legislators that this is not a slam dunk sure thing in terms of the public vote. California, they tried and failed several times before they amended their constitution and created their citizens commission. More close to us in Ohio, they have mm-hmm. failed twice in the past 8 years at public votes to create an independent commission. And they haven't lost by just a little bit. It's been a landslide, about a 60 to 40 vote. What has happened?
Where does the opposition come from?
It comes from out of state, and well-funded conservatives in the case of Ohio came in, spent millions of dollars on television advertising last time with basically just a general message saying don't amend the Constitution for political reasons. So we obviously will take whatever route the General Assembly chooses to take. We would obviously prefer not to have to amend the Indiana Constitution since that is such a cumbersome task. We have top national experts who believe that we could model a law that would create an independent commission, allow the General Assembly to vote on the maps that they create, and that would pass constitutional muster. Yep.
We are talking about rethinking redistricting here on No Limits. David, welcome to the program.
Hello.
Hi, David. What's on your mind?
Yes. Well, what I'm curious about is I'm really interested in this, and I really appreciate this show because I think this is a very serious issue about and probably explains the gridlock. in our politics. But I'm also curious about, is there a wider issue here about the question of winner-take-all elections? In many other democracies, it's not the case that you simply have one winner of an election. You have two candidates, one winner takes the, you know, he takes all of the prizes home, as it were. And I'm just curious if that's also on anybody's agenda or there's consideration. I know it's a much broader issue, but I'm still kind of interested in what your panel would say about it. Thank you.
Good question. Thanks for the call, David.
Sure.
Well, I'll throw that one to Debbie first.
Oh, I think that David, you're bringing up a very important point, and it's something that Julia and I have said many, many times, that this is not the only answer to some of the issues that are facing us in our country. And then even to go back to the California model, that their redistrict independent commission was a part of a broader election reform. And I think that we have to think of a broader reform, and it's going to involve lots of different things, but redrawing these lines so that they are more competitive, then that is a one part of the solution. It's going to be a multifaceted solution, but we feel that this is a great place to begin.
I'll ask a related question to David's, too. I mean, is there any thought, particularly with the lower chambers in many places, just expanding the size of the membership? I mean, we now, at least at the national level, we've got members of Congress who represent more people than George Washington did at the time. And the idea, at least, of that chamber is that it was supposed to be closer to the people. Julia.
The numbers are set in the Constitution, so that would be another constitutional change that would have to be made. You know, David makes good points about proportional representation and getting away from our winner-take-all elections. You know, that really came into the news in the Republican primary in the 5th Congressional District when, you know, nobody actually got a majority of the vote in that primary, or more than 50%. But, unfortunately, it is extremely difficult to get anybody in the Indiana General Assembly interested in this topic. Even redistricting is more interesting to incumbent legislators than things other than winner-take-all.
We've gotten an email question from a listener named Colleen. Says, why wouldn't it be possible to use a computer program, nonpartisan, to develop compact districts based strictly on numerical population? One of our current congressional districts contains a strip that runs from Delaware County to well into southern Indiana. This would seem to allow voters to choose legislators, not the reverse.
Yeah, computers can absolutely do this. The problem is who programs the computers. Mm-hmm. And as long as you have incumbents, legislators doing that, there is no way to take away their self-interest to manipulate it. You have
to have...
Yeah,
my guess is they use computers to draw
these. They absolutely do. They have very sophisticated software that has, you know, created... they have fine-tuned how to do this via computers. You know, it's what is their motivation? And we've got to take away the inherent conflict of interest that exists when you allow incumbent legislators to draw their own maps. The only way to do that is to give the job to a truly independent commission.
Is part of the problem? I mean, as we've pointed out, gerrymandering's been around as long as America has been a country. I mean, the term itself, gerrymander,
right,
comes from the
goes
fact that,
back.
Yeah, that
Eldridge Gerry.
Yeah.
Created a district that looked like a salamander,
right,
and the joke became that it was a gerrymander.
Right.
So it's a long-standing problem. Has the technology, though, now exacerbated the situation because it is now... With the surgical precision.
You can slice and dice voters down to the neighborhood block. Mm-hmm. And literally, you know, it is diced up that finely. And so computers have just made an art that is very old and used to be pretty crude, much more sophisticated.
Well, and I think those lines get drawn and they absolutely follow the letter of the law, but it's the spirit of the law that we're looking at. It's are they neutral? Do they support minority rights? Are they natural? Are they natural boundaries? You know, those are the things that it's like Julia said, how are we going to program these computer programs and what are the values that are going to be guiding them? And I think those are the questions that if you have real people who are neutral and really concerned more about the democracy and not incumbency protection, they're going to ask the harder questions.
Are we stuck with basically the current situation until 2021? I mean, is that, are there any steps that can be taken to mitigate things between now and then, Julia?
Well, no, we're stuck the current districts. I mean, there was an attempt back in the 90s. The Republicans tried to redistrict in the middle of the course, and they were not successful in their efforts to do that and most likely would have been ruled unconstitutional. But I think our point is that 2021 seems very far off, and it is several years away. But if we're going to do redistricting reform right, we have to get started now. It took California 2 years to set up the rules of how they would select their commission. And so, you know, if we're going to have a truly independent commission, we have to think through the process of how you create that. They will need some rules to follow. They will have to have some place to work. So the devil is in the details, and we have to get started now. Unfortunately, there's absolutely no urgency in the General Assembly, because from their perspective, this is a job that they just finished a couple of years ago and one that won't resurface on the horizons. And so really the public is going to have to demand reform. And that we really want a grassroots process, because we can't expect incumbent politicians who benefit from the current system to be the leaders in reforming it. It's going to be have to be a citizen-led reform process.
Well, and I guess that's... How do you frame that argument? Because I guess, Debbie, as I'm looking at this, if I am the Speaker of the Indiana House of Representatives or the President Pro Tem of the Indiana Senate, I'm looking at this and thinking, okay, I've got supermajorities here.
That's right.
Why mess with a good thing? Why mess with a good thing?
That's right. Well, I think that that's a great question, and I think the short answer to that is because it's the right thing to do. It supports our democratic process, and that's what we're called to do as citizens and as elected officials in this state, in this country of ours. I think it also goes back, though, to one of your callers' question is, how are we going to get people involved? Well, guess what? Democracy is not a spectator sport, as the founder of the League of Women Voters said. And we have to raise the awareness to say to voters, you know, 2021, as Julia said, it's a long time from now. We start now. Call your representatives, call the General Assembly to say, you know, we do care about this and we want you to take this up. It's going to have to be a citizens advocated, because there is no real reason that the General Assembly, there's no urgency and there's real no short-term reason for them to take this up.
And Julia, if people want to do this, this is your moment to give the call to action. How should they go about it? If they want to send a signal to the legislature and perhaps to the governor that this really matters to them, how should they go about doing that?
Well, the legislature is going to be back in town, believe it or not, a week from today is Organization Day at the General Assembly. So they're going to be starting to file bills and think about what their agenda is going to look like. And so it's really important during a short session, there are actually limits on the number of bills that legislators can introduce. So we've got to get to them early and get in that lineup. So calling, writing, relating this story about, you know, I used to be represented by Andre Carson, somebody who I felt was a good match with me. Through redistricting, I'm suddenly someplace else. I didn't move, but my representation radically changed. Those personal stories of how you think redistricting impacts you, because believe me, legislators think they're the only ones who are impacted by the way that lines are drawn. So creating a sense of urgency around this issue. Contacting, in particular, the chairs of the Elections Committee is really important. Representative Milo Smith, who represents the Columbus, Indiana area, is the chair of the House Elections Committee. So he needs to hear from Hoosiers all around the state, as does the Senate Elections Committee Chair Sue Lansky, who is up in Lake County, Indiana.
That will have to be the last word. We have been talking about redistricting here on No Limits. I am John Kroll. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producer, Sharon Alseth. Interactive Media Coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical Producer, Jeanette Rhodes. And Board Engineer, Don Hibschweiler. We invite you to join us each week for No Limits, made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.